Welcome to the Holistic Trauma Healing Podcast. I am Lindsay Lockett, your host. The episodes of this podcast weave together a web of healing. The conversations shared here are created with love and the belief that awareness, curiosity, authenticity, and vulnerability are our most necessary and powerful healing tools, and they are already within each one of us. The spider's web has served as a great teacher for me. Webs are designed in such a way that the tiniest vibration in one part of the web ripples out and vibrates the entire web. Through this intricate network, every thread is connected. Nothing happens to one that doesn't somehow affect the others. Each human is a strand in the collective web, and inside of you exists the threads of body, mind, spirit, emotion, ancestry, and community that make up your web of life. It is not unlike the web of neurons in our brains or the web of the nervous system that connects each system and part of our bodies together. Everything is connected. I hope this podcast helps you get to the root of how trauma has affected every part of your existence and helps you weave a new web of life that isn't ruled by the past. Hello, happy October. I am recording this on Saturday, October 7th, and today my day has been spent doing homestead things. So it's the time of year where it feels like we're kind of in a rush to beat winter and beat the snow and all kinds of things that we need to do around our property to get ready for winter and kind of button things up to go to sleep for the winter. So the garden, making sure we have enough firewood for our sauna and then our maple syruping pile because we will be syruping in March, and making sure the chicken coop is all cleaned out with new bedding in it for winter. Their old stuff, old poop and hay and things out of the coop and put onto the compost, squash vines pulled out of the garden, carrots harvested, beets harvested. Chickens have been in the garden today doing some cleanup, just foraging around and eating slugs and worms and plants and weeds and all the things. And I live for homestead days like this. But that is not what this episode is about. So in this episode, I am going to share a recording of my appointment with my psychiatrist that I had this past week. And I keep a yearly appointment with him. And it's the first time I've ever recorded our conversation. And he did not know that I was recording the conversation, but it's my healthcare, so I feel like I'm allowed to do whatever I want, and I'm also not going to share his name or any identifying information about him. But before I share the recorded appointment that I had this past week, I would like to just tell you a brief history of my journey into the world of psychiatry. So back in 2019, I was in the middle of my dark night of the soul in the winter of 2019. So December 2018, January, February, March 2019. I had been experiencing really terrible anxiety and panic attacks almost constantly, as well as debilitating nightly insomnia, where I could fall asleep around 10 or 10:30, but by 1 a.m., I was literally wide awake, gasping, shaking, crying, and then couldn't go back to sleep. So this went on for about 5 months, less than 3 hours or 4 hours of sleep a night for 5 months. On top of that, anxiety and panic attacks and rapid weight loss, despite eating all the time because I was so hungry all the time. And in January of 2019, I went to my GP, my general healthcare provider, and I was like, I need something for anxiety. Like, I cannot keep living like this. I need a pharmaceutical for anxiety. And she made me take a survey for depression. And I was so pissed that when I got called back into the meeting place, the room where you talk to your doctor, I had David come with me and I was like, I'm really pissed off that you made me take this survey for depression. I don't have depression. I'm not sad. I'm anxious as fuck. I'm not sleeping. Like, I'm not slow and heavy and I'm anxious. I have anxiety. I need something to help with anxiety. And she wanted to put me on an SSRI, but thankfully I had genetic testing information to prove that because I have multiple cytochrome P450 mutations, my body doesn't metabolize SSRIs properly, specifically because of the mutations that I have at the pathways known as CYP2C19, CYP2A2, 2A1, and CYP2D6. So these are the most common pathways that SSRIs are processed on. And mine are very mutated, like heterozygous mutations, meaning I have mutations that come from both my mother and my father. So thankfully, I got out of being prescribed an SSRI that was never going to work. But I feel like what she did was extremely irresponsible for a medical professional. She said, okay, I will prescribe you 15 half milligram Ativans, which is a benzodiazepine. The generic name is lorazepam. And I will not refill this prescription for you, so don't come back and ask me, and I'm going to refer you to a psychiatrist. But by the way, the wait time to get in to see the psychiatrist is 9 months. So this was early January. I remember the date. It was January 4th, 2019. And I was somehow supposed to make 15 0.5 milligram lorazepams last from January until I could get in to see a psychiatrist in September with no hope for a refill. Completely fucking irresponsible medicine. So then once I had the Ativan, I wouldn't take them because I was like, what if I get worse and I need it more another time? I would try to push through and say, oh, I can get by without taking it now. I'll just try, you know, like I'll do some other stuff. I'll try a supplement. I'll try a, you know, valerian root or whatever, which all of that was bullshit for me. It was not working. But I was so afraid I was going to run out before the referral 9 months down the road that I wouldn't take them. So it made the problem worse, actually. So on March 7th, 2019, with no help medically, and no appointment in the near future to get the appropriate psychiatric help I needed, and the sleep deprivation continuing, the anxiety and panic attacks continuing, the weight loss becoming even more dramatic, I attempted suicide on March 7th, 2019. And I was obviously unsuccessful. And I checked myself into the psychiatric hospital locally to me. And I willingly admitted that I had been ideating and had attempted to take my own life. And that's like an immediate free pass to get into the psych ward if you've attempted suicide. So I got in knowing that I was going in for pharmaceuticals. Like I knew I was not coming out of the hospital without psych meds. And sure enough, 5 days later, I voluntarily checked myself out and I was on a cocktail of three separate psychiatric medications. So I was on an antipsychotic called Seroquel, not because I was psychotic, but because at low doses, like 100 milligrams, Seroquel can be helpful for sleep. I was also on 45 milligrams of mirtazapine, and I was on 1 milligram per day of clonazepam, another benzodiazepine. So whenever I was discharged from the hospital, I was given a referral to outpatient psychiatry. And again, the referral was the same one that I already had. So the earliest available appointment was at that time still in September. I was basically like on the list to see them in September. 4 months after getting out of the psych hospital, I decided that I wanted to start tapering down the clonazepam because I knew at that point I was chemically dependent on it. You can't be on a benzo for more than 10 to 14 days without becoming chemically dependent because it interacts with your GABA receptors rapidly and changes brain chemistry rapidly. This is why benzodiazepines are so easy to get addicted to, and it's also why they are such a bitch to come off of. So I started to taper myself down. I did a lot of research on different methods of tapering and decided that the safest, easiest way to taper would be to do a micro water taper. So dissolving the pill or crushing the pill into water, mixing it together, and then using a baby syringe to take out milliliters. So very, very small reductions. And it was July of 2019 whenever I started my taper of clonazepam. And between March and July, because I couldn't see the outpatient psychiatrist, I had to have what was called a bridge provider. So this is a psychiatrist that I saw in the hospital, and she's the one who put me on this cocktail of psychiatric medications, and she was the one that would be responsible for my refills and appointments so that I would have something between March and September. So I was tapering myself off of clonazepam. She knew I was tapering myself off of clonazepam, and it came time for me to get a refill of the clonazepam. So I called in asking for a refill, and she said, "I'm not going to refill this for you." And I was like, "But I'm trying to come off of it. Like, I can't just stop taking it. I'm trying to wean myself off, but I'm doing it really slowly." And she was like, "No, you just need to cut the pill into quarters and reduce by 25% per week for 4 weeks, and in a month you'll be off. So I shouldn't need to refill it for you." And everything that I had read, specifically from what's called the Ashton Manual, I will link it below, which is a very slow way to taper off benzodiazepines, had said that the typical recommendation to taper a benzo 25% per week for 4 weeks so that you're off in 4 weeks, although common and mainstream, is not a safe way to come off of these drugs because it takes a long time for your brain chemistry to catch up to that rapid of a reduction in medication. So I was like, shit, like, I cannot believe that I'm trying to come off of this medication, but she won't let me do it at my own pace. And miraculously, the next month, an opening came up. I was on a cancellation list, and an opening to finally see the outpatient psychiatrist came in early August. And I remember preparing myself, because at this point I had had to advocate so much for myself with medical providers. I had had to insist on them respecting my genetic testing information and not prescribing typical SSRIs like Prozac, Lexapro, or Zoloft. I had really had to fight for myself to be heard and to be respected by conventional medical providers. And this is a really common thing that people go through. Like, I'm definitely not the only one who's dealt with this. Like having to be a tenacious bulldog when it comes to advocating for yourself and your healthcare. So when I got this appointment, I was first relieved because I didn't have to wait another month or month and a half. But then at the same time, I was also skeptical and worried because I didn't know who this new provider was going to be. I didn't know how he was going to behave towards me and towards my desire to do this slow taper. I didn't know. And so I walked into his office on my very first appointment with him in the summer of 2019. And I had a folder full of papers and notes that I had taken and my research from the Ashton Manual. And I came in ready to advocate for myself. And I sat down, and he said immediately, he could read my energy and my vibe. And immediately he was like, "I can tell you came in here prepared to fight for yourself, but I'd really like to hear your story." And I felt this like instant opening in my body where I wasn't tense and I wasn't afraid and I wasn't skeptical because I felt like he was treating me like a human being. And so I told him my story. I told him about my childhood. I told him about growing up in religion. I told him about leaving religion, moving from Texas to Minnesota, my husband going through a really hard time in 2018, and that sort of being the catalyst for my own mental and physical breakdown from late 2019 until I attempted suicide in March. I told him about my research, about how I was a food blogger at that time, about how I was learning to be my own advocate. I had read the Ashton Manual. I told him everything. And he was like, "Well, you sound really educated. What do you need from me?" And I said, "I just need you to keep refilling this Clonopin, this clonazepam, until I'm off of it. And I need you to know that I'm coming off of it. I'm diligently coming off of it, but I want to do it at my own slow pace because I don't see any reason to put myself through any more suffering in order to come off of a medication when I can take my time." And he said, "You got it. You got it. I'll keep refilling it for as long as you need. Just check in with me and let me know every once in a while what you're down to in your dosing." He remarked on how smart I was, on how well prepared I was, how informed I was. And we started off on a great foot, and we've had a very respectful relationship ever since. So he supported me through my first benzo taper. He then supported me through the tapering of mirtazapine. He then supported me again whenever I was off of everything and the insomnia and anxiety relapsed, and I chose to go back on medication for sleep. He supported me through that. When my body reached tolerance to that medication, he supported me in tapering off yet another benzodiazepine. And being able to email him and then have my yearly appointments with him has been one of the most powerful backup plans or plans of preparation that I never knew I needed, but I'm so grateful I have. And whenever I wanted to start the Nemechek protocol for brain healing and reducing brain inflammation and gut healing, he, my psychiatrist, is the one who prescribed my SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth antibiotic rifaximin, that is part of that protocol. He's also refilled my asthma inhaler for me. I mean, he's just done all kinds of things that you would not think a psychiatrist would do, because refilling an inhaler and taking antibiotics for SIBO is not really in their wheelhouse of antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications, and antipsychotics. And he and I have just developed a friendly, respectful relationship over the past almost 5 years. And even though I don't take psych meds regularly, I do have to use one to sleep occasionally if I have a relapse of some insomnia. So that's okay. I'm okay with that. But I know what it's like to be without the psychiatric care you need. And I also know how hard it is to find a psychiatrist like mine. He is truly a unicorn. And so I keep him in my back pocket just in case, right? Like, there is an ease and a lessening of tension and anxiety just knowing, even though I don't ever expect to get as bad as I was, just in case I ever do, I have someone who's on my team, and I have someone who's not going to push pills on me, who's going to let me choose what I want and what feels most supportive for me, who understands my sensitivity to substances, to changes in routine, to changes in daylight exposure, to changes in temperature. We have our appointment every year at the end of summer or beginning of fall, because that tends to be the time when I usually have an uptick in anxiety and insomnia. And it's happened every year for the past 4 years in the fall. And just knowing that I have him and that he's there for me, and I can email him whenever I need to, and he responds to me usually within like 3 hours, is such a relief, such a relief. So that is my history of how I came to absolutely love my psychiatrist. And I might be the only person on the planet who can say that, because I have definitely heard horror stories of people who are like, "How did you even find this person? Like, he's a diamond in the rough. He's a unicorn. Like, my psychiatrist is horrible." But I have no doubt that this is just one of those instances where the universe totally came through for me, and I was divinely guided to working with this particular practitioner. Interestingly enough, in 2020, he actually moved out of the state of Minnesota, and he moved to a different state. And I was like, I cannot be without you. Like, what do I need to do to follow you and continue receiving care from you? And so what I ended up doing was making an appointment with a general practitioner who's in the clinic network that he's in, paying for it out of pocket, of course, because it's out of state, and also because I don't have health insurance. And then getting on the telehealth visit with this general practitioner who had never met me before in my life, and literally just saying, I don't need anything from you except a referral to this psychiatrist who's in your clinic network. And she was like, okay. And so she gave me the referral, and I was able to continue my care with him without skipping a beat. And for the last 3 years, once a year, I see him on a telehealth visit. And I just had my telehealth visit for this year, this past week. So what you're about to hear is the majority of that conversation. And I hope that it gives you just an insight into my relationship with my provider, into hearing a, air quotes, conventional and mainstream double board certified psychiatrist and psychologist, but also hearing how unusual he is and how unusual and special our patient-doctor relationship is. So that's what you're going to hear next. I hope you enjoy.
So what's the state of things at this point?
The state of things, I just in the last 2-3 days am feeling a lot less anxious. Last night I got 7 straight hours of sleep, which is the first time in several weeks that I've achieved that. I've also just been doing a really good job of just taking care of like my gut, just eating really gentle foods, and also noticing that I think part of the anxiety was a little bit of like low blood sugar, because it seems like the more I eat, the better I feel. And I don't mean I'm eating my emotions, like I'm not eating instead of feeling, I'm just noticing, oh, like this anxiety feels like it might actually be hunger.
Right. Well, I mean, that sort of thing is it's all of a piece, because it represents the sort of intertwined nature of all of these chemical considerations for you, but also how much minor shifts in either direction for any of them can create a ripple effect. It may not be causative, low blood sugar, for example, but adjusting it, it's kind of like telling someone that, you know, because your TSH is low normal, your thyroid's fine, even though there's a lot of normal range left. People do it all the time, but it drives me crazy because it's just not always accurate. So, no, I think you're keeping all the levers in front of you. I mean, I envision the old, like, switchboard operators just kind of pulling the different pins around.
That's how it feels.
Building that board took a while. I mean, this morning as I was going through your notes, and my own notes from the scan of the old SLH records, I mean, you could see this process and this buildup, and but also kind of where it began to pull away. And that's why, I mean, as much as with time, the advisability of new things is going to change, I'd just as soon try to work with what's here.
Yeah.
Because I think you know it. I think you have an instinctive knowledge of what you're feeling here. And I mean, I don't want to pile on too much on this topic, but the fact that there was an interpersonal catalyst here, coincidentally or not, is not to be minimized. It's the sort of thing that is a real subconscious trigger and quite a minefield in any case. But I mean, this hit very close to home, quite literally. So, I mean, I think also just recognizing how vulnerable you are to not just the vicissitudes of I get depressed from time to time, or it's the light is changing with the season. I mean, all these things certainly factor in, but there's also that kind of lower level response to upper level human concern that can't get sort of pushed aside either. It can't all be about amino acids and, you know, PEA and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, part of it was reading, again, reading my notes as well, reading our hospital notes, our initial hospital notes. And just the difference in tone in describing you and describing your report and your presentation had a lot to do with the absence of any sense of empowerment at the time. You just felt totally at the mercy of these things happening to you. And that's what has changed the most over time. It's not that you have been cured of your problems. It's that you are no longer bouncing around the back of the boat on stormy seas. You're steering the boat on stormy seas.
Sometimes, yeah.
Exponentially better than being just tossed around in the back. It's just that getting up to the front was tough.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's the trajectory's the same. It's just, again, it would be nice to go, you know, a whole year without any kind of a physical or mental flare.
Yeah, and it feels like if I'm gonna have a flare, it's gonna be this time of year. Like that's it really is. So we're being proactive in that. Back in the spring, we've already booked and paid for a 2-week trip to Mexico. We're going in a month. So we're going to be there for 2 weeks at the middle of November to the end of November. And then we've also booked another trip from middle of February to end of February. So I'm hoping that by kind of bookending my winter with trips to the tropics, that not only does it give me something to look forward to and something that I know I can count on that will make me feel better if I'm not feeling good, but it also shaves 4 weeks off of winter, which feels like a gift.
What's your artificial light regimen at this point? Do you have anything firm?
I mean, I have a light. What are they called? I don't know, one of the lights that a therapeutic light. Like, I have one of those.
Light therapy box.
Yeah, a light box. I have one of those. Mostly what I've been trying to do, like now, although I know as winter gets closer, probably using the light is beneficial, but what I've been trying to do is as soon as I wake up in the morning, if I wake up at 4 a.m., I don't do this, but I'll lay in bed in the dark and I don't get on my phone or anything. I don't turn on lights. I don't read books. I don't do anything. But around like 6, 6:30, 7, I open my curtains in my room and I just let some natural light in. And that seems like it's helped since I started doing that. But I am open to using the light box. For sure.
Well, it's by the time it gets thick of winter, that's going to be your daylight for the early and late parts of the working day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, really, it's don't try to use it like the old instruction manuals and stare at it. It's the kind of thing that just needs to be in your periphery somewhere during those hours when you want your brain to think it is time to be active.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, and so I was thinking more specifically, though, about returning from these trips.
Okay.
And kind of thinking about how to do an almost like a light taper when you get back.
Okay.
As you get back to that latitude and just, you know, kind of wean yourself down, unless you just want to try to simulate, you know, kind of taking stock of where the light hours are, wherever you are going to visit, and then essentially cut and pasting up here. If it's dark up here, up there.
Yeah.
If it's dark up there and it was light where you were coming from, just have artificial light somewhere and turn it off when there's natural light to be had. But then, the thing that became kind of the Northland rule that nobody else had to do is then there's you turn it back on in the late afternoon thing.
Sure.
Most of the data on direct light as an influencer of mood involves the angle of the direct light and what the atmosphere does to it. And that angle is something on the order of like 30 degrees. I mean, you can still have the sun above the tree line and have it not quite be doing what you needed to do.
Yeah, totally.
But then also you get that melatonin cascade begin because you get pulled too far behind. Even if you turn the light on, now you're playing catch up, and that kind of ripple effect can also be detrimental. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's an art to it. But just thinking about it as a non-invasive option in your case, I mean, the obvious impact of it is one thing, but it's also just nice not to have to worry about a dose. It's really just an on or off kind of situation.
Yeah.
Unless you get one of those, you know, fake dawn alarm clocks. You know?
I don't have a clock in my bedroom at all.
That is very un-American. Just put it that way.
I would like to share, if you have time, to talk to the psychologist in you instead of the psychiatrist in you. Last fall, I visited my mother. She was having back surgery in Amarillo, and she asked me to come stay with her after her back surgery to take care of her. It was a pretty major back surgery. And so I did. And she, you know, whether it was because of anesthesia or she was on painkillers or whatever it was, she began to display some of her behaviors that are like really big triggers for me, such as like giving me the silent treatment and being passive aggressive towards me. And it's only been since 2020, 2021 even, that I've even had like awareness that the physical abuse that I experienced from my stepfather is not actually the core wounding of my life. It was actually the emotional abandonment from my mother of whenever she would give me the silent treatment and be passive aggressive. And then I learned to people please and like do things to earn her love and attention and attunement and attachment back, and kind of throwing spaghetti against the wall and going, well, maybe if I wash the dishes, that'll get her to come back. Or maybe if I clean the house, that'll work or whatever. And I just, so obviously I've done a lot of personal work. And so whenever I went and saw my mom, I like held it within myself, like, okay, she's had surgery, she's gonna be in pain, she's coming off of anesthesia, she's on hydrocodone, like have patience, have grace, like all that. And then at a certain point, I was with her for 2 weeks. And at a certain point, whether she was on drugs or not, it didn't matter. I was just like, I have to set boundaries with this person. Like, she cannot treat me this way and expect me to stay here and take care of her. And there were moments when I feel really proud of the way that I did that. And I was able to use my communication skills and stay calm and all of that. And then there were other moments when I was like an 8-year-old child, and that's how I was reacting because I was so triggered by her behavior. And so I got home from Texas at the beginning of October of last year, and my mother hasn't spoken to me since. And this is the first time in my life I've ever gone a year without talking to her. And I have no doubt that that is kind of a contributor to the interpersonal stuff that I was telling you about in the emails, because now that I'm really aware of this trigger and like the complex PTSD emotional abandonment being kind of at the core of the onion, like the physical abuse is kind of the outer core. And it was always easy for me to see that my stepdad hitting me, like, yes, that's abusive, that's wrong, that's unfair, it's not my fault. But I was like 37 or 38 before I realized that the emotional abandonment of my mother, it never occurred to me, oh, this is wrong and it's not my fault, until I was like well into adulthood and realized I'd sacrificed authenticity for attachment. And that's what was triggered so much, you know, 6 weeks ago with David and the non-monogamy thing, was David was having these very real feelings of just insecurity and jealousy. Like, not that he wasn't consenting to being in a non-monogamous relationship. Like, he was totally consenting. We're friends with these people. We're still friends with these people, even though the relationship is sexually over. There's no awkwardness. Like, they're still our family up here, basically. But he was having these really normal feelings of jealousy and insecurity, which, of course, as he's sitting with and processing those, I perceive that as withdrawal, like he's withdrawn from me. And so that poked the button really, really hard, because it felt exactly in my body the same as it felt when my mother would do that to me. And of course I had awareness of it, and I was able to use language to talk about it. I had awareness about it. I was able to be curious about it. I was able to like communicate, here's what I need, here's what I think would help. Like, all of that was there. And yet, for 6 straight weeks, I was so hypervigilant to his body language, his facial expressions, to the point that he would use a past tense verb instead of a present tense verb. And I would be like, why did you say that like that? Like, or he would sigh, and I would be like, why are you sighing like that? What does that mean? Like, I was just the fuse was so short, and I was so anxious, and like, I feel like that's coming down now. And that was the whole reason that we stopped non-monogamy, because I was like, this is like peanut butter to me. No matter how much I want it or how great it is, if I'm fucking allergic to it, then it's not good for me. Like, no matter what I do, it's not good for me. And like, I can admit that, and that can be okay. And it is okay. And so we've decided that non-monogamy is not for us, and we can still have loving relationships with our people. that are non-sexual, that feel secure, that don't feel scary, that are not peanut butter to me. But I've realized that this last year, a lot of the stress of that has actually been noticing the urge to pursue my mother the way that I did as a child and not allowing myself to, because I wanted to break that pattern in myself. Because as a child, my pattern was, I could energetically, because I'm sensitive, sense that she was withdrawing from me. And whether it was because she and my stepdad were having a fight, or they were having money troubles, or she was having a bad day, or what, I don't know. Because as a child, I'm not able to be like, oh, my mom's behaving like this because she and my dad had a fight. I'm thinking she's behaving like this because I did something wrong, and I have to figure out what it is so that I can earn her love and attachment back. So, like, that's also like something that I'm acutely aware of that I feel is relevant to share, is that I noticed in the beginning, from like October to probably February of this year, just I had to keep stopping myself from picking up the phone and texting her, calling her and being like, mom, is everything okay? Can we talk? Did I do something wrong? Like that hypervigilant, anxious sort of attachment, you know? And now I don't feel any desire to like pick up the phone and call her or anything. She did email me back in April and basically said that the way I treated her was unacceptable and that she would never tolerate that again and that she deserved an apology and blah, blah, blah. And I emailed her back and I was like, I hear that you have pain and that you have things you need to say. I also have things I need to say. Would it be possible for us to have a mutually beneficial conversation? Are you open to that? Her email back just said, I am, and that's it. Like nothing like, yeah, call me tomorrow or whatever, like nothing. And so then I was left in the question of like, okay, so once again, is it my responsibility as the child to make this happen? Like, is it my responsibility to set this up? Because she's the one who cut off communication. So I feel like it's her responsibility to initiate it, but she kind of did by emailing. But then when she responded back, she didn't. So then on my birthday, she texted me. It was my 40th this year in May. She was like, happy 40th. I hope you have a fabulous day. I love you. I was like, okay, great. She's ready to talk. So I texted her back. Thank you. I love you too. Could I talk to you later today? And she was like, well, I've got a lot going on today. I'll let you know. She never got back to me. So then her birthday was a month and a half later in July. And I texted her, happy birthday, mom. I love you. All she responded back was thank you. And there hasn't been any contact since. And so like, I feel okay with how things are. And I feel like if I never talk to my mom again, I will be okay. And like a year ago, I wouldn't have been able to say that. But I feel like if I never talk to my mom again, I'll be okay. But I also cannot deny the fact that it's like this complex PTSD emotional abandonment wound has been poked again and again and again this year, and very intensely over the past couple of months. So I'd be curious about any insights you have about that.
Well, I mean, you've clearly done the right analysis about the roller coaster itself. I think what is hard to reconcile about the kind of relationship you're describing with your mother is that your point of reference was created at a time when you did not have the cognitive ability to form an opinion about it. You had only the bad modeling going on. I mean, this is how we learn to be emotional creatures, is through the modeling that we witness from our closest adult figures, and we're vulnerable to them in a way that makes anything traumatic from them all the more resonant later. And it means that there isn't, it's kind of like trying to medicate a personality disorder. It's saying there is no normal under here for us to get you back to. A medication can't create the normal whatever. So it's only going to be able to do so much. It's kind of like that here. The insight into childhood traumatic experiences, the more obvious overt ones, physical, sexual abuse, et cetera, but the more insidious ones, emotional neglect is kind of what you're describing. Emotional abuse, someone who was just kind of berated and belittled, it's also, it has a kind of obvious proactive nature that emotional absence or a kind of distance or coldness does not. But it's the same result. You end up sort of adrift emotionally and having to figure it out later in life on your own when your brain is not supposed to be doing that. The final pruning process is over around the time you figure out your childhood sucked for most people. And that is it's a quirk of nature, and it's also a very dastardly thing about abusing young people, is that you don't give them an opportunity to make it up later. But also, humans being fallible and adhering to the old statistical principle that future behavior is best predicted by past behavior, you can also say that what part of what your conflict is with your mom is that you kind of know what she's doing. You know that as much as you want to have a reconciliation with her, and as much as she may say some words to that effect, it's not in her nature. She doesn't have the capability to do it, or she would have done it over the course of your 40 years of life. So to say you may never speak to her again, I think what's a lot more likely is that you'll never speak to her in a satisfactory way. It will either be the asymmetrical, she is being passive aggressive and directing your emotion thing that she is comfortable with, or it will be superficial. That's the only level you can rise to transcend that into a kind of mutual understanding and respect, is to ask a lot of someone who's what, 60, 65 years old?
65.
And also not inclined to do so.
Yeah.
And the problem with that kind of asymmetry is the person who wants, from your position, to come to terms with the relationship wants to feel more comfortable. The person who's coming down from that position of misused authority has to become uncomfortable in order to meet you in the middle. And so again, unless there's a strong amount of motivation there, what you're likely to get is kind of a Lucy in the football kind of thing for Charlie Brown. You may be very tempted to kick it, but it's going to be pulled away at the last minute somehow, kind of like a text that says, oh, I'll get back to you. Because what's happening there? That's her seeing you as back in that position of, I am beseeching you for something. So now she has the ability to take it away and be back in charge of this relationship. Why does she have to do it? It might take years of psychoanalysis, but it's also something that I hear a lot, especially in mother-daughter relationships. This weird kind of, I have to keep this child in a particular cage, and it's not a sort of cinematic, you know, they're still my little kid thing. Even when the person was a kid, it was like, they've got to be compartmentalized. I cannot connect. I've got to have a wall here. For whatever reason. But I think that for you to not connect the idea that formed your idea of what it's like to be close to someone, that would be the mistake, that you're seeing the parallels now in other relationships and recognizing that underneath, in that limbic area where logic cannot penetrate, by design cannot penetrate, you will not think about the saber-toothed tiger, you will simply run from the saber-toothed tiger. That's what's happening under there. It's going to be more and more frustrating the older and more mature you get, because it is such a primitive response, but it can be tamed. You just don't want to try to kick the football with it. If you have a spouse who can say, we've gotten too close to the fire, we together will back away from it, we will then together move forward, and you trust that that's true, then eventually the alarm bells, like we said in our messages, eventually it will fit. Not necessarily right away once the decision's made, but it will. If you try to do that in a situation where there isn't an honest broker playing along with you, and again, with parental asymmetry, sometimes it's just never coming, then you're going to be at risk every time you try. And, you know, some people that I've encountered over the years feel like it's worth it because they don't want anybody dying before they can say they did their best effort at it. And I say, as long as you consider the possibility that you will be disappointed by a nonagenarian as much as you would, you know, a middle-aged version of your parents, then go for it, but be ready to be disappointed, because it doesn't get easier or more likely with age.
Well, probably the most stark revelation that I've had during this past year of not having my mom in my life is that my life is not worse.
Which is, again, a reference to what we are supposed to assume about our parents, which is that they are vital to us. That's not supposed to be aged out of. The relevance changes, the proportion changes with time as you become an autonomous adult. But that core, I learned how to be an emotional creature by being around the people that were my protectors, That never changes and is always at the root of all of this. But it isn't, it's a jumping off point. It's not the top filter, it's the base. And so, yeah, if you focus on the present doggedly, if you say, even if it's not your choice, someone cuts you off and is estranged, you have no choice but to take in the environment around you at a given time, to live in the present, so to speak. And you will find sometimes it's kind of like someone who has to go cold turkey from some kind of drug, that initially the difficulty is more about the absence of consistency. But then the new normal sets in and turns out to just be normal, to not be anything scary. Doesn't mean you're not vulnerable to being drawn back into that thing that was so familiar. Those synapses are still lying dormant, waiting to bite you.
Yeah.
But the idea that you have to prostrate yourself, to prostrate yourself to someone who is not going to respect it and is not going to be reciprocal is... It's just, as I often have to say, there's no gold star for being a martyr. There's nobody waiting to give you praise for allowing yourself to be tortured, other than maybe yourself. And that decision, I've seen it go both ways, man. I had a patient up there around you guys who was just abused physically and mentally in every which way by a husband, but she just wasn't going to leave. And even when he became too infirm to chase her across the room and she had her out, she wouldn't do it. And I can remember saying to her, by the time we'd gone around it for years, you're making the decision now based on all the necessary information. So there really isn't a right or wrong. But I can tell you right now, it's the minority position. Most people would be out the door because you've got a lot of years left. And it's been like with parents, it's gone the other direction. In fact, that's becoming more and more popular. The generation right behind us is not particularly interested in participating in the lives of their parents very much. I wouldn't paint with that broader brush, but it's a lot more frequent. I hear a lot more of that, and it's baffling. Older people do not understand why their kids don't seem to have any interest in seeing them or speaking with them. And it's not in cases where there's some drama, it just doesn't seem to be a priority. So I think that you're learning that you can later on kind of nurture that abandoned kid and say, yeah, this is a scar. The scar is never going away, but you don't have to look at it in the mirror all the time. You don't have to go visit a person who's going to remind you it's there all the time either.
Yeah.
But it also, it doesn't mean you have to be binary either and say, well, if I can't have a meaningful relationship with this person, I can't have any. You can have a surface level, superficial kind of how's the weather, happy birthday kind of relationship in order to at least know if they're still alive and all that kind of stuff. That's not.
Thankfully, I have a brother. I have a brother who will tell me. We have a great relationship, and he'll tell me if anything happens. But I'm no longer willing to sacrifice my own authenticity for attachment with my mom because I don't need that attachment anymore. And it took this year of being without her to finally realize that I actually don't need that attachment anymore. In terms of the synapses still being there, lying dormant, waiting to be triggered, what I've developed over the last year and a half since I've had awareness of this, and especially in the last year, is I can't seem to stop the trigger from happening. Like if David or my best friend feels withdrawn or something like that, that the synapses still fire. But so I can't, I don't know that I would say I've given up hope. I haven't given up anything, but like I've come to accept that maybe healing it doesn't necessarily mean it's totally gone and resolved and I never have to deal with it again. But what I have developed over the last year and a half is the ability to notice when the trigger is happening and then to use my words and say, I'm perceiving that you are withdrawing and it makes me think I've done something wrong. Is that real? And like, I've learned to say that in safe relationships. And then they have the opportunity to be like, no, I'm not withdrawing from you. I'm having a hard day or I'm tired or whatever.
It's grounding. You're grounding yourself in the present, which is it's what I was saying earlier. If you can just tip that proportion over to I am more here than I am back there, then you'll be able to weather it. It's going to hurt. I mean, again, it's the core. It's down at the bottom. It's the middle of that gobstopper. Everything else is layered around. Without it, it's not that you're better. Without it, you're not there. It's part of you. Yeah. And was made a part of you by parental figures who did a shitty job. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It's not that if you just kind of, you know, bang your head against the wall the right way or shake it loose or something like that. I come back to this concept, but whether it is, someone who is fine for years and gets assaulted or somebody who lives in a war zone, the thing about trauma in the developmental years is that one is robbed of the autonomy of moving on. That's the thing that is really the most dastardly about traumatizing another person, passively or proactively, is that you take away some element of what would have naturally happened in their evolution if you had never come along. And the idea that a parent would do that seems like a terrible thing. It seems like this sort of perversion, but they get the best opportunity out of anybody that you'll ever meet to do something wrong. Again, sometimes it's very unintentional and sometimes it's just pure evil. Because the other sort of favorite analogy of mine is that your parents are no better at being people than the jackass in the next cubicle or the next to you. The difference is, if the jackass next to you does something to offend you, you're going to speak up about it and feel right to have done so. With a parent in particular, but really any family member, it's just like there's this automatic sense you have to put up with a certain amount or be belittled to a certain degree. And the freeing thing that people eventually come to accept is that it isn't written anywhere that you have to. You can choose to, but you don't have to. And the more you are around a person who is like that, who is going to bring that out in you, the more you're going to have to practice setting boundaries. So a lot of the time, the solution is just don't be around them very often. It's the whole I'll see you at Christmas kind of thing. But it's... it's a process that you learn this way as you separate from the source. You get it from what triggers it from the present. The thing to never fall a victim to, if you can help it, and it sounds like you're working on this pretty diligently, is to superimpose that entirely over the trigger thing and pretend they're the same. This is the same as what is at the core. It's not.
Right.
What is in front of you is what's in front of you, and your perception is colored, as all of our perceptions are, by everything you experienced before.
Yeah.
So if you can start to say, that's the premise, I am perceiving this way because I'm wired to do this, because I was forced to be wired to do this, then that's where the logical top-down, the cortical portion of the brain can start to be first and say just what you said, what's actually happening. And if you need to verbalize it, as you often do when it's communication with another person, it's another person you're perceiving, then you'll be able to verbalize the right thing, which is not, how dare you say that, you horrible individual? It's, did you mean what it sounded like you meant?
Yeah.
Give somebody a chance to explain themselves. But also, with the same caveat too, especially with a spouse, to say, if you did mean the not so nice thing, tell me that too, because we also need to process that. Don't just feel like every time I say, what did you really mean, is you have to automatically backtrack and apologize. It means to be honest.
Yeah.
Because then you start to trust better. It's that kind of trust in a situation helps. But if there are hard lines in the sand, respect them. If it is, there just isn't a way to have a non-monogamous relationship and have me be comfortable here, then just don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't suffer necessarily. It's not, like you say, it's peanut butter. You're not going to die without it. It's just, that's the straws that you draw. So much of your exploration of this happened like a drop in the water. It was like the flashpoint, the severe depressions, and then these ripples outward that show just how far that particular body of water goes. And what you've been working out since is how deep it is. And I think you've got it pretty well mapped, but I mean, it's practice. I wish it's like practice in medicine. They never say you're done with the medicine, you just retire. I think that's kind of like this. You'll have opportunities to work out what does and doesn't suit as the years go on. But ideally, though, the intensity level will diminish, the longevity of any kind of breakthrough episode will diminish. And if you have to be quote-unquote artificial about dealing with it by working with all these little supplements and vitamins and prescriptions and things, so much the better. It's nice to have it. It's nice to have things that you wouldn't have had a century ago, when I guarantee you parents were just as problematic as they can be now. So anyway, that's my quarter and a half.
That's perfect.
For that. But as always, I trust you to at least meet yourself where you are. And that's almost the whole ballgame. I mean, if you don't spend a lot of time and energy deceiving yourself about what it is that does and doesn't work for you in life, then you're well ahead of the curve. I've said that phrase more and more often as I've gotten to what I was reassured by all kinds of interesting emails at this last year's the halfway point of my career. Meeting yourself where you are is really the best definition of good mental health that I've been able to come up with. Doesn't mean that where you are is some sort of panacea or paradise, but if you're not doing that, then you're spending a lot of energy doing something else. How are you going to improve?
Yeah.
So hopefully the next few months are back to more normality. Are you still engaged in all your various pursuits, professional stuff? And
my professional life has taken off. In less than 2 years, I built a 6-figure business. So
easily done.
Yeah, I'm teaching people from all over the world at this point. My focus is on helping people understand polyvagal theory from a layman's perspective. So I teach about polyvagal theory, and all of my work is informed by polyvagal theory. I say that I'm at the intersection of the nervous system and awareness and curiosity is kind of like where my work lies, of just like being able to feel what's happening in your body, get curious about it, actually feel it, not try to pathologize it or judge it or medicate it away, but like, what am I feeling in my body? Where do I feel it? And what's the voice in my head saying about it? And that's what I teach at this point.
That's fantastic. That sounds very much like the approach that was taken by a therapist up there named Jake Walsh, who refused to let anybody use their diagnoses if they came in with them in any kind of personalized way.
So yep.
Made you put them aside. This is incidental terminology.
Yeah, and I'm grateful I have my diagnoses because, like, you know, it's a lot easier to say the term complex PTSD and understand what I mean by that than to start listing off hypervigilance and anxiety and social, you know, and like, it's a lot easier to just say, yeah, I've got complex PTSD. So that's really helpful. But yeah, I mean, I don't feel like a victim of it anymore. It's certainly annoying whenever I get stuck in a trigger that can go on for weeks. But at the same time, like, I do know the difference now that my husband, even if I get triggered in the container of our relationship, which I do, or with my best friend, those are the two relationships I get triggered the most in. It's not because they're bad or unsafe people. It's because we do have a reciprocal safe relationship, but I still have wounds that they poke sometimes, and they don't do it on purpose. If they were poking my wounds on purpose, that would be abuse. But they're not doing it on purpose. They're just being themselves, and I'm being myself, and our orbits bump up against each other. And sometimes that hurts. And to be able to have language and say, you know, here's what's coming up for me. Here's what I'm feeling. Is this real? Is that what you meant? Here's the boundary I need to put in place. Like, I can do that with these relationships. Whereas obviously in my relationship with my mom, like, I can't do that. And I never will be able to do that because my mom is always a victim. And ever since I've been an adult, my mom, like in the drama triangle, I'm the perpetrator. My mom's the victim. My brother is the rescuer, like 100% of the time. And I just want to remove myself from the triangle. I don't even want to be a participant in the triangle anymore.
Well, it doesn't achieve anything to be in it. And I think your ability to detach is as good as it's ever going to be because you have so much else going on in your life. You're not beholden to those old patterns out of fear that there's nothing else out there. You know there's plenty.
Yeah, I do.
No, that sounds fantastic. And again, as always, I'm impressed, but optimistic. And so if you ever just need me to remind you that you do very well most of the time,
I might.
I'm more than happy to send you a blurb in the morning. But I mean, as it stands, I'll keep filling the things you need. We'll keep you on the books down here. And that's about all I got. I think I probably ought to shut this down. I'm surprised it hasn't shut us down. I've heard tell from the therapist that at a certain point it reminds you you should be done by simply cutting off the connection.
Wow. So, yeah, that seems a little unethical and irresponsible, especially if someone was in a crisis or something.
the folks who invented the EMR could care less, let me tell you that much. It is... I prefer this system to the one we were using. I prefer just about everything to what I was doing up there, but it's still not made for clinicians nor patients, this system. We have to kind of chip away and create our own path to where we need to go.
For sure.
Yeah, but we do that.
Well, you did notice that, I mean, I had to pull teeth and yell at people over the phone, but I got my records for you.
You did, and I very much appreciate that. That is... You are, I think, maybe the only person, and I've talked to a lot of people who've had to do that. They're just, I don't know what's going on in their records department. They're just sitting around eating Cheetos or what, but they don't seem to want to participate.
No, they don't, but I bitched them out, so.
Well, you got it. And another just sort of cliche of Dr. Lindsay's appointments is you've got to be a squeaky wheel these days. That's the only way you're going to get results. The medical system, there's so much automation, so much cut and paste, so much nonsense that it just, you got to somehow stand out. And that's the best way to do it, sadly, much of the time. It's just
appreciate that you are a squeaky wheel of a practitioner, because we go together really well. And I always keep my appointment with you, because even though I know I may not need anything from you, I never want to be in a situation again where I don't have you. So I appreciate you.
Okay, now it's just me again. I hope that was insightful or helpful to you in some way. I think the thing that stands out to me the most is on my psychiatrist's side, his understanding, even though he didn't use the words complex PTSD, because he can't, because it's not an official diagnosis in the DSM, is that he has an understanding of developmental trauma and how that forms the brain and nervous system throughout life, right? Like that development is what informs your whole life. And sure, we can learn nervous system tools and we can reduce brain inflammation and we can have awareness of our traumas and awareness of the voices in our heads and all of that. And also, we still have a predisposition for those developmental synapses that are formed in our brains to fire. And that's what triggers are. So his language and his understanding of trauma, developmental trauma specifically, his insights into my relationship with my mom, all of that I hope is like really revealing and insightful to you. And then the other thing that was revealing to me is my own ability to communicate about my experiences and my triggers and how I've worked through them in a clear and coherent way. So I felt really proud of that conversation. It does feel really vulnerable to put it out there on the internet, because I know that my mom or other family members could totally listen to my podcast. And, you know, I can imagine that if my mom were to ever come across my podcast, the last two episodes in particular, that could be really hurtful to her. But I've also just decided that, like, this is my story. And I'm allowed to tell my story from my own experience and my own perspective without prefacing it or explaining it, or because I'm not trying to villainize my mother. Like, if you haven't heard the last episode of the podcast, episode 103, I talk in a lot more detail about complex PTSD and emotional abandonment from my mother. It's called A Year Without My Mother. Episode 103. I'll link it below in the show notes. So if you need some more context for that, I really encourage you to go back and listen to that episode. But the way that I'm able to describe to my psychiatrist my triggers, my experience of the world, the hypervigilance, the language and the vocabulary that I've developed both with myself and in my intimate relationships, all of that is essentially my body of work now. To me, that's what feeling without fear means. It was only through feeling without fear and being willing to confront these uncomfortable parts of myself these uncomfortable truths about my family of origin, these uncomfortable truths about the mother-daughter relationship that I've had with my own mother for my entire life. It was only through being able to confront all of that with a willingness to feel it that I've come as far as I've come, and come so far to the point that my very mainstream conventional psychiatrist notices the difference in the level of empowerment that I have now versus the level of empowerment that I had when I first saw him in 2019. And that means something is working, right? Like, it just feels so validating, and it means something's working. And so in December of 2021, the phrase "feel without fear" dropped into my awareness. I was experiencing some mysterious pelvic symptoms. This is long after I had had pelvic floor physical therapy and had had my pelvic veins embolized due to pelvic congestion syndrome. And so it was like I was experiencing these pelvic symptoms and pain, and I couldn't even think of an explanation for what could have been going on in my body. But it was still going on in my body. I was still feeling really uncomfortable, and it triggered health anxiety. And I wanted to go down the Google rabbit hole and like figure out what was wrong with me. But I also knew like, that's not who I am anymore. Like being this like obsessive, compulsive, Googling hypochondriac is like not who I want to be anymore. And so I was laying on the couch in my office when I still had a couch in my office. And I was just massaging my pelvis and kind of placing my hands over that part of my body because that was all I knew to do to show my body some love, some compassion, and some support. And the phrase, "feel without fear," just popped into my awareness. And at that time, almost 2 years ago, I had no idea that that was going to become the language that I use to describe my experience of awareness and curiosity and complex PTSD and my window of tolerance, noticing the voices in my head, developing safe reciprocal relationships, setting boundaries, expanding, contracting, widening my window of tolerance, meeting myself with compassionate non-judgment, and practicing and living all of that over and over and over is how I am embodying the woman I am today. The woman who my practitioner through a screen can go, the sense of empowerment that you have now is so different. It's so noticeable. And as he said, it's not that everything that ails you is totally gone, right? It's not that you're cured of all of your problems. It's just that you're no longer being bounced around on stormy seas in the back of the boat. You are now in the front of the boat. You're driving the boat. And sometimes the seas are stormy, but you're still driving the boat. So I'm not perfectly healed. I don't have an expectation that I'm going to be perfectly healed. If healed means fixed, resolved, it's totally gone. I never get triggered ever again. I never feel an uncomfortable feeling ever again. I never get dysregulated again. Like, I am so over that completely unrealistic definition of what healed actually means. And also, I no longer feel the compulsion that I used to feel to be perfectly healed, to be totally over it. I'm just living my life now. And if I get triggered, I face it. If I need to set a boundary, I set a boundary. If I need something in a relationship, I ask, even if it's really uncomfortable. When I have voices in my head, which I do all the time, I try to notice them curiously and have the courage to question it instead of just believing it as the truth. Because more often than not, the voice in my head is a voice of fear. It's a voice of my inner critic. It's not the voice of my highest self. When my window of tolerance is small, I allow it to be small, and I make the sovereign choice in that moment of, am I going to lean into the discomfort and widen my window of tolerance, or am I going to choose to not lean into this discomfort because I don't have to face everything, right? I don't have to be uncomfortable all the time to be healing. if I fuck up, I take responsibility for myself and I apologize and I don't feel shame if I need to apologize because I allow myself to be a human who fucks up sometimes. If I need to say no to someone, I just say no and I don't say no and then feel guilty or second guess myself or doubt myself or change my mind. I honor my boundary. And so 4.5 years after meeting this psychiatrist, this is what healed means to me now. It doesn't mean I'm cured of all of my problems. It just means that my problems are not what's steering the boat. I am who is steering the boat. And this is what I would love to teach you to not only intellectually understand, but also embody in my group program, Feel Without Fear. It's literally my journey over the past 4 years of coming home to myself, where my inner voice is my authority. And I no longer have room in my life for relationships where I can't be authentic because I am so done sacrificing my authenticity for surface level attachment. I'm so done being on the health anxiety hamster wheel. I'm so done blaming my triggers on other people when really those other people are just holding a mirror up to me and it's going, hey, here's where you're not aware yet, or here's where you're not healed yet, or here's where you don't have language yet, or here's where you need to set a boundary, or whatever. So I'd love to invite you to Feel Without Fear. This is my group coaching program. It is 6 workshops and 6 group coaching calls that are really spread out over 4 months. And the reason why I spread it out over 4 months is because this shit takes time to integrate. 6 workshops and 6 group coaching calls, I could have easily made the program 6 weeks long. And I almost did, but I felt the program as I was creating it saying to me, slow down and spread it out. And so that's what I did. And I just finished the first cohort of Feel Without Fear. We had our final integration ceremony this past Wednesday, and it was so beautiful because I could see the vulnerability and the authenticity that each one of the women who have been in this program have come to embody over the past 4 months that we've been working together. And the way that they speak, the way they share, the way they moved, the way they expressed was night and day different compared to the women who first showed up to that group. It was incredibly beautiful. And I was crying by the end of it with just awe that I got to witness it and that I got to be a part of their journeys. I mean, like, wow. So Feel Without Fear is open. It's open until October 31st. So you still have plenty of time to decide if this is the program for you. You can learn all the details on my website, lindsaylockett.com/feel. And I just want to encourage you to not just skim through the website, but actually read it and pay attention to your body as you're reading the information on that website so that you can feel into what your body is asking for. You can feel into, is this a yes for me? Does this feel expansive for me? Do I want to sign up for this in a grounded way, or is it like more urgent because I'm trying to fix something? Does it feel supportive? Does it feel like there's a part of me that's like, yes, like feel into that? And I know we have such a pattern of being in a rush. And so all we do is we skim and we don't actually read details. But if you'll slow down, again, slow it down, spread it out, really read and feel as you're reading so that you can make a grounded, solid decision about whether Feel Without Fear is for you or not. The group option is one way that you can participate. So you'll go through it as a group. And believe me, the community that develops inside of here is next level. There's also a private plus group hybrid option. And I have 1 spot for that left. So I'll put the link to Feel Without Fear down below in the show notes. And then one last thing, I want to read to you what one of my clients who was in the program, she shared with me, she was trying to send me an Instagram DM and she typed so much that it wouldn't go through. So she sent it to me in an email. So I will read her email to you. So Wendy said, "I want to tell you that yesterday's closing ceremony was beautiful and so very special. You truly go above and beyond for all of us, and what a beautiful way to celebrate us together. Thank you so much for that and all the heart you bring to your community. The Feel Without Fear series has been incredible. It has laid the foundation for me to continue integrating all that I have gained from this life-changing experience. You are truly amazing, and I am grateful to know you and learn from you. My life has pivoted and I have grown tremendously because of you. Joining Feel Without Fear and your other courses has by far been one of the best and wisest choices I have ever made. I'm so glad I chose me and gave myself this gift. You are one of a kind, a diamond in the rough for sure. Thank you for this safe space to come to and connect with others. The value of doing something like this with others is next level powerful. Our group is full of such incredibly special souls. I will cherish you all forever as part of my journey. I can't imagine a life before knowing you and all the gifts you have brought to my life and heart. I clearly could not thank you enough, but I can try. I have told you before and will say it again. Anything you teach, I am here for it. I look forward to what is ahead. Thank you for showing up with all your heart and sharing so authentically always. There is nothing like learning and connecting from someone who just gets it. I am a huge Lindsay Lockett fan. Thank you for being you." What a beautiful testimony to such a powerful container. So if you are feeling drawn to Feel Without Fear, head to the show notes below, click on it, read about it, feel into your body if it feels like it's for you or not. And if you'll join in the next week, I will give you for free my foundational workshop, Nervous System 101. You can watch it anytime between now and October 24th. And then on October 24th at 10 a.m. Central, we're going to gather for a live Q&A. We'll just hang out together and we'll chat all things nervous system. So I'll put the link below for that as well in case you aren't feeling pulled to join Feel Without Fear, but you still want to snag Nervous System 101 for yourself. And if you have loved this episode, I would appreciate it so much if you would give me a good 5-star rating and leave a really great, awesome review, because it will help my podcast be found by other people. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end of this episode. Stay in touch with me by joining my email list at lindsaylockett.com/email. And feel free to follow along on Instagram at @IAmLindsayLockett. Finally, you can check out all of my offerings, including courses, private coaching, and workshops on my website at lindsaylockett.com.